Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We always appreciate your ears. You could be doing anything at this time. Thank you for listening. We continue our Decade 9/11 series today with two of our favorite guests, Brooke Gladstone, who you know is co-host and managing editor of On the Media and author of The Influencing Machine, Brooke Gladstone, On the Media, and Fred Kaplan writes the War Stories column for Slate Magazine, slate.com, and is the author of books including 1959, The Year Everything Changed. They're both veteran reporters with a deep interest in their beats. They're New Yorkers. And on 9/11, they were both parents of teenagers as the nation set about coping with grief, anger, and loss. And Fred and Brooke are married, forging a literal bond between military coverage and the media in their Brooklyn home. Sounds professionally incestuous to me. It's been a bizarre and uneasy 10 years for the relationship between the two beats. I have no idea about their personal relationship. After Bill Maher's program was canceled in 2002 for criticisms he made of the U.S. in Afghanistan, White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer admonished him this way.
The reminder to all Americans that they need to watch what they say, watch what they do. This is not a time for remarks like that. There never is.
Ouch. The president, through his spokesman, telling the media to watch what you say. And then there was the familiar George W. Bush pep rally for the military.
I said a long time ago one of our objectives is to smoke them out and get them running and bring them to justice. We're smoking them out. They're running. And now we're going to bring them to justice.
Now, if the media helped mislead the U.S. into the Iraq War, we can only imagine what Brooke and Fred's dinner table conversations in the past 10 years have been like. And today we'll hear a taste. Hey, Brooke. Hey, Fred.
Hi. Good to be here.
We all remember, I think, our first phone calls of that day. Do you remember when you first spoke to each other?
Do you remember, Fred? I know that we were both in perpetual
motion. I think it must have been like a three-second conversation, which of us would call the school or something like that. That was about it. We were both.
And in the end, neither of us called the school. And what happened is that one of their friend's parents signed them out. And they went to school in Brooklyn Heights. They had to be signed out by a parent. I actually got on the phone to give permission to a parent who was there to sign them out because I was running on the Brooklyn side from one bridge to another, trying to get across into Manhattan, and I kept getting repelled by the police, and Fred was already in Manhattan.
I think I was one of the last people to get out at that subway stop, at the World Trade Center subway stop, and was standing there. I was standing next to Michael Powell, who now works for the New York Times, who lived a block away, and we were both wondering what was going to happen, and then the building crumbled right before our eyes, and we ran.
Did you get caught in the smoke and the dust and the rubble?
Fred did.
A little bit. I mean, more so than I thought I did at the time.
My perception of it was from the other side. I kept watching people tromping off the bridge, both bridges, covered in white dust, like living statues. I mean, we all know what the picture looked like. And then all these vendors outside of the bridge entrance holding out bottles of water that people would take just as they walked. They looked like statues, like soldiers or everybody just come to life. The whole thing was terrifically unreal on that blazing, against the blazing blue sky and the black smoke.
It was your first year hosting On the Media. Did you do a show that first Sunday?
We were blown out of the building, and we were preempted that first show. What I did do was I talked to Scott Simon as I looked at the New York skyline. I did a live show, a call-in show from Columbia University. It was a national call-in show, but our own show didn't get on the air until a week later, and of course, the whole station was being produced out of the PBS offices.
And you talked with Will Ferrell about the future of comedy.
And I talked to Will Ferrell about the future of comedy in that.
Because remember, at that time, everybody was saying, oh, irony is dead. Nobody will be able to tell any political jokes ever again.
And that went on for some time, the irony is dead. But I think it was a very tricky thing for any of the comedy shows. I mean, David Letterman cried on the air. It was a big deal when Saturday Night Live came back. We played the White House's reaction to Bill Maher. Mm-hmm. And he lost his show over it. He went on to probably even greater success.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the Bill Maher remark that got him punted from the air had to do with the use of the word cowardice in response to the terrorists. It wasn't a criticism really of the American bomber pilots and people in the fighters who are above high in the sky in Bosnia and elsewhere having dropped bombs from a distance. He just said that, you know, it's not cowardice to kill yourself. Maybe it's lunacy. I mean, clearly it's lunacy.
I think he did contrast the people who killed themselves by crashing into the building with the American pilots dropping bombs from 10,000 feet. I think he did make that contrast.
Yeah, he did. He contrasted.
You know, I mean, in retrospect, if you made that comment today, I mean, you'd get a lot of bad mail, but I don't think you'd get thrown off the air for it. There were, you know, very, very tight sensitivities at that time.
It was the time of a patriotic litmus test, more so than any other time in my life for the media. It was the time of flag pins. It was the time of watching what you say, not just the media, but everybody, really. And interestingly, throughout this entire period, this need to say the right thing related far less to government interference than it did to fear of one's audience and advertisers, that they would turn against you. And I think that we saw that chill running through the whole media, and ultimately it had a devastating effect on the coverage of the run-up to the war in Iraq.
Listeners, do you want to get in on this? 10 years of media and the military since the 9/11 attacks. I realize that's a huge general topic, but are there moments, are there media moments that you remember, maybe they've even been recent, as emblematic of how the media changed, not only for the worse, maybe also for the better, after 9/11, your call on that. And what about the military? Anybody who's been in the military want to talk about that? Anybody who enlisted after 9/11, probably took a certain kind of person to enlist after 9/11, knowing about the possibility that you would go to war being greater than the years immediately before it, or anyone else, as we have our latest Decade 9/11 conversation between On the Media host Brooke Gladstone, host and managing editor, and Fred Kaplan, the War Stories military affairs columnist for Slate magazine. They happen to be husband and wife. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Fred, you've had a decades-long career writing about the military and U.S. foreign policy. I think the first book of yours that I read was in the 1980s called The Wizards of Armageddon,
right,
which was about this whole nexus back then. But on 9/11/2001, you were the New York bureau chief for the Boston Globe, right?
Right. I wasn't covering military stuff at all at that point. I'd been a military correspondent through the 80s and until the end of the Cold War. Then Brooke and I both went to Moscow to be reporters there, and then I came back to New York, and I was doing all kinds of things. Then, of course, when the military action started again, I got back into that a bit and then left the Boston Globe at the end of 2002 to go work for Slate.
Did the relationship between the media and the military change after 9/11? I was thinking of like a thumbnail sketch of the last 60 years mm-hmm. this morning. The media was a military booster in World War II, gradually became a military skeptic during Vietnam, was locked out by the military in the first Iraq war right. in the 90s, so they couldn't be skeptical and show those pictures like in Vietnam, then wooed back by embedding reporters with troops for sympathetic reporting in the Iraq war. I mean, that's a 60-year history.
Yeah. Well, there were two things. I mean, one, the military did get much more sophisticated in their handling of the press. They learned a lot of lessons from the bad experience of shutting everybody out in the first war. They also had a new generation of officers, many of whom were quite adept at dealing with the press, the most shining example of which, of course, is General Petraeus. But then also, I think it was different because this was a war that at least started, the sequence that led to the war started with an attack on the United States. And I think that, you know, that created a whole different dynamic from the beginning.
How'd that look to you, Brooke?
It seemed to me all of a piece going back. I liked your 60-second précis or 30-second précis of the history of the media and the military very much. I do think that, as Fred said, the attack on the it was advantage to the media after the attack on U.S. soil. And after that, it was a mad scramble for equilibrium. I mean, people weren't just afraid of their audiences and advertisers. They were in pain themselves. I mean, reporters are people, and that's a problem. But the recovery took far too long, and the reporting was far too credulous over and over and over again. And of course, the military's, I think, ugliest moments was when they made up stories for the U.S. press to cover, like the Pat Tillman story, where he died from friendly fire and we were all told he died in enemy fire, or the Jessica Lynch story, where she appeared to have shot herself to freedom when really, you know, when she was taken captive, and really that's not the way it happened at all. And there's, of course, a lot of question about the handling of the emblematic moment of the toppling of the statue of Saddam.
Anthony in Secaucus, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling up.
Hi, how's it going? I'm glad to be on the show. I was a freshman in high school when 9/11 took place in Jersey City, New Jersey. And I remember walking home that day and seeing the whole cloud of smoke follow me on my way home and all my friends talking about it. And by the time I graduated high school, I enlisted in the service. You know, I come from a long family of military people, and I was brought up to believe we're the greatest, you know, we're the best. This country is what everyone should strive to be. And after joining, and I went to Afghanistan, and thank God, no, nothing terrible. But after joining, just hearing stories from other people who have gone to other places, and when I got to see some of the citizens over there in Afghanistan, I felt like we were given such a one-sided story here that got me to enlist in the first place. And I felt like I wasn't really doing the job that I thought I was enlisting to do. You know, I didn't feel like I was saving anyone or being patriotic. I felt really crappy about having made that choice. You know, and it reflected. A lot of my family had not wanted me to join, and some did want me to join.
When were you in Afghanistan? What years?
I went in 2006. I went for 6 months for a small security detail to relieve some. I was a reservist here in New Jersey. We relieved a small unit there that had just gone through something, and it wasn't a terrible place we were at.
Well, you were probably there maybe at the worst moment because, you know, after the Taliban fell, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld declared that the war was over and then moved everything off to Iraq. And by early 06, most of the activity in Afghanistan was handed off to NATO, and they went down south, at which point the Taliban came out again to fight. So the fight was ginning up, and yet there was no U.S. strategy for it whatsoever. There were few U.S. resources for it. It really took, I'm very skeptical about the war for a lot of reasons, but it took more than 2 years for the U.S. to form even the beginning of a strategy for what to do there.
Can I ask you what it was you felt you got, the media steered you wrong? What was the message that you got that didn't reflect the reality you saw?
From this point of view, my biggest thing was after when I came back from Afghanistan, they wanted to send me to Iraq. And that's where things kind of really jumbled in my head, where I was like, I thought I was going after Osama bin Laden in some caves, and now you want me to go to Iraq and tell them what to do. I didn't even understand why that was relevant. Mm-hmm. And I actually left the service as soon as I found out that we were going to get deployed to Iraq. I handed back all my equipment. I was like, "Well, I can't." It just seemed like it wasn't what I thought. For the 4 years of high school that I thought, you know, joining the service was going to be some, you know, some great move for democracy and helping other people around the world. And it's a dirty, nasty thing the military is. Yeah,
do you remember what news sources you consumed mostly in high school?
Well, most of my jobs, you know, I worked lobby jobs and security jobs. So most of the time I would listen to what's in the lobby, and it would be Fox or CNN. Just a few of the major news, nothing crazy.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But I didn't know anything political in high school. I really didn't follow anything. I just thought, you know, I thought this it was just, and I didn't question that it was, that there was any unjust thing about it.
Anthony, thank you so much for your call. We really appreciate your candor. And we will continue this Decade 9/11 conversation with Brooke Gladstone from WNYC's On the Media, Fred Kaplan, Slate's military affairs columnist, and your calls, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to our webpage for this at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And by the way, our politics website, itsafreecountry.org, is now the place for smart coverage of the 2012 presidential race. Now, tonight and tomorrow night on the site, we will have live online chats simultaneously to the Republican presidential debate tonight and President Obama's jobs address tomorrow night. So join the live chat during the debate tonight beginning at 8 o'clock. I'll be there and lots of other folks at itsafreecountry.org. We're actually going to start a little early tonight so we can chat with each other before the first word, 7:45, if you want to join on, log on that early at itsafreecountry.org tonight for the Republican presidential debate. We continue with our Decade 9/11 series of conversations here on the Brian Lehrer Show. We're trying to pair people. You've hopefully been enjoying our pairings over the last 2 weeks. Jonathan Safran Foer and Franklin Foer together, our 2x4 segment, et cetera, et cetera. And today with Brooke Gladstone, co-host and managing editor of WNYC's On the Media and author of The Influencing Machine, Brooke Gladstone on the Media, and Fred Kaplan, who writes the War Stories military column for Slate.com and is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation and is writing a book now on the history of counterinsurgency. And, oh, by the way, they happen to be married, as we talk about the media and the military and their family 10 years on. John in Connecticut, you're on WNYC. Hello, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you for calling.
I just would like to comment on, I was a senior executive for a major news organization. I don't want to get into it, but it was like this whole thing was promoted as a war to watch. And the media just was sucked so into this.
Are you talking about 9/11 itself, or
no,
Iraq?
The Iraq War.
Shock and awe.
Absolutely, it was like watch tonight here on Channel 7.
Yeah. Well, thank
and
you.
Where was our responsibility as journalists here?
Right. And Brooke, I think that really began in the first Gulf War.
I was going to say that was the video game war when everybody was in a hearing room or in a press room, and they were shown videos of smart bombs. Fred was actually at a number of those and was suspicious of them from the beginning, if you don't mind my saying so. But, I mean, from your point of view, Fred, when you compare the coverage of that war and this war, it seems like there were a number of lessons learned, which is great videos, also the use of numerous armchair generals,
yeah,
many of whom later were found to have been connected in some way to the Pentagon, or, I mean, these are retired generals that were connected to the Pentagon, yeah, or to various defense industries.
Well, that was happening with this war, too.
Yeah.
I mean, the first Iraq War, keep in mind, people don't remember, the ground war part of that lasted 4 days. There was 30 days of bombing and then 4 days of a ground war. You were completely locked in. You couldn't go freelance. There was nothing to see on the bombing. They had a few cool videos of a smart bomb going right through the chimney. You know, of all the bombs dropped in that first Gulf War, only 9% were smart bombs, and they weren't that smart back then. Most of it was just B-52s dropping gravity bombs on soldiers in the field. This war, you know, the troops were out. I mean, the reporters were out with the troops. Some of them left and went on their own. They got a real taste of what a war was like.
But let me say something about how carefully this whole embedding process was designed. You fought for a really good place with a unit in the front line or in the field. But if you left to see not just where the bombs went off, which is where you were, but where they landed, if you left, you would lose your place and it would go to the next correspondent. So you were signed up to stay. You enlisted essentially with a military unit as a reporter. And then you had to count on other people. They were called unilaterals to report the other part of the story. And those people had no military protection at all. They were terrifically at risk. And so a lot of this coverage was seen through the proverbial soda straw, as they said, a very, very narrow view.
Fred Kaplan, your stance on the Iraq War early on was actually given a bit of spotlight this week when Bill Keller, the outgoing executive editor of the New York Times, mentioned your position in support of the invasion of Iraq originally. You supported it for, as you put it, a mere few weeks in February of 2003 before the invasion began. But that cycled back into the New York Times Magazine this week.
I saw that, yeah. And then he called me Nostradamus for switching, which I guess is okay. What I was convinced by at the beginning, there was one piece, and really only one piece, of Colin Powell's presentation to the UN. And that was he read the transcript of an intercepted telephone conversation between two Iraqi officers, one of whom was telling the other, "Now, the inspectors are coming to that site tomorrow. Have you cleaned it all up?" And they said, yeah, it's all clean now. And so I'm thinking, well, God, that sounds awfully suspicious. That sounds like they got some word through a leak that the inspectors were coming and they're clearing out all the chemical weapons. And so I said, I'll go with this. And then I got the impression weeks on, and it happened with a George Packer story in the New York Times Magazine, where he quoted somebody telling George Bush that, okay, well, you know, after the war is over, you're going to have to deal with this underlying conflict between the Sunnis and the Shia. And it was clear that Bush had no idea what he was talking about. And I'm saying, okay, forget it. This thing is going to be a disaster. It's going to turn into a civil war. It's going to be horrible, not worth it.
Hence the Nostradamus remark.
Yeah, right. The mystery of the Powell thing was cleared up a few years later because, you know, our guys went and interviewed all these people after. It turned out that this site had been cleared out years ago under the UN sanctions after the first war, and the one officer wanted the other officer to go in and make sure that everything had been cleared out 10 or 15 years earlier, which just is another way of showing that, you know, before you go into war, you'd better have your intelligence awfully firm.
And Powell came to believe that he was misled into saying that.
He says that he was duped. Yeah.
Andy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Andy.
Hi. I called really because I actually was a Army broadcast journalist in Iraq.
The missing link between the military and the media.
Yeah. I've actually worked with quite a few of y'all. I did a lot of the escorting of the embeds, what Brooke was just talking about. And I was in the 1st Armored Division. My general there was Martin Dempsey, who is now in the news because he's a new Joint Chiefs. We thought we were all fighting kind of the good fight when they were talking about weapons of mass destruction, and you could totally see a lot of the older officers, they're kind of brows furrowed when no one ever found anything, and then slowly started getting enmired in the Sunni Shia situation in Baghdad, and we're basically about 3 days away from redeploying to Germany when they told us, Muqtada al-Sadr's militia just took over plenty of parts of the country. You got to stay for another 3 more months and take those back.
What's it like being a journalist who reports on the military in the military?
Well, it's not... you know, obviously there's no real fairness doctrine. You know, I mean, we don't report propaganda per se. We report, as probably many of your guests have heard before, the good news story, which is, you know, we built a school, we did good things for people. It's all true. It's just that one of the problems is that, you know, people at home, you know, stateside, want to hear what's happening to their kids. They don't really care that much about hearing about schools that we built for people they don't know. And unfortunately, most of the reporting that goes on about their son or daughter ends up being some press release about how either Humvee in non-combat situations fell into a canal and people died, or there was a combat situation and this many people, you know, were wounded, this many people, you know, were killed. I was older. I went into the military when I was 32, so I was a little more wary of some of the directions that we were given. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, I did find that things were, you know, generally fair, and I really enjoyed working with the press. I just, you know, I mean, there is kind of a bias with public affairs officers in terms of, you know, who. You know, who is good to the military and who is not good to the military. Mm-hmm. Fox was really good to the military, and they got, you know, choice selection.
Thank you so much for your call. I really, really appreciate your insights. And I know the listeners do, too. Brian Lehrer with Brooke Gladstone and Fred Kaplan in our Decade 9/11 Conversation Series. So what was it like at home for you guys during this time? I mean, on the day of your daughters, were how old?
They were 16.
Twins?
Yes. And they went to school in Brooklyn Heights. And when we were running around, Fred was running around in Manhattan. I was running around trying to go back and forth and get into the city. And when I finally reached them, and they went to a friend's house nearby. But one of my daughters told me that standing on the promenade, you saw the smoke and you saw a wave of paper and debris from the towers blowing straight to their feet, straight across the water to their feet, throughout the streets. And to me, that was just such a potent symbol of its long-range effects. These were visible artifacts from the towers just landing like snow all around them.
And what'd you tell them, Fred? What'd you tell them about what it meant?
Well, you know, they were 16 at this point, not 7, so they could read the papers and figure out a lot. But it's, you know, we had just come from Moscow, where we were both Moscow, and just a few years earlier, their school, or the embassy where they often went, was right across the street from the White House, where there were an occupation by fascists and where Yeltsin's troops
and tanks.
Yeah, attacked it with tank shells, and then the school was let out for several days. So, I mean, I don't know whether they think that this is just the normal state of things. They aren't traumatized, which I find to be kind of miraculous. But, you know, you do wonder. I mean, you know, Norman Mailer wrote this essay in 1957 where it started out that it's impossible to calculate the psychic toll on people who lived through the Holocaust and Hiroshima. Okay, well, September 11th was neither the Holocaust nor Hiroshima. But you have to wonder, the combination of a terrorist attack on your city and then kind of a stagnant economy, I think this must have some kind of effect on the state of mind. I think when Brooke and I were both growing up, there was so much, you know, the economy was very healthy. There was no notion of being attacked. I think there was just a much more carefree kind of thing. I never had to worry about getting a job. And when you do have to worry about getting a job and when you've experienced your own city being attacked, I don't know what – I don't see any tangible consequences of it in our own kids, but there must be a certain cautiousness.
I see cautiousness, and I don't see – I mean, our kids are different from us. They are more grounded. There's far less sense of entitlement. They look at the future and they see work and care, and I won't say that they're risk averse, but they're risk sensible in a way that I wasn't. And I do think you that think that's a lingering impact.
A lingering impact and a generational thing, maybe from the state of the economy, too.
Yes.
One more call. Nick in New Jersey, who I think is going to ask a very uncomfortable question. Nick, you're on WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
Hope it goes to Fred.
Now, let me preface this in 10 seconds by saying this in no way is intended to justify what these horrible terrorists did on 9/11. But I think to this day, the mainstream media, especially the commercial mainstream media, has totally failed to get the American people to understand why they did it, why so much of the Arab street hates us with such a passion, with such a vengeance. And to this day, the consequences of the American people not understanding that have allowed the war on terrorism to continue in such a way that it continues to deplete our economy, it continues to deplete our military, and we still don't get it, and we continue the same policies.
You know, Brooke and I often have this line where when somebody says, how come the media doesn't cover X? And we say, well, where did you learn about X?
But I think he's right.
Well, he is right to accept. But then again, I also recall, you know, mainstream media, you know, Fareed Zakaria, this is what made him. He had that long cover story in Newsweek, maybe 2 weeks after the attack, headlined, Why Do They Hate Us? Which I haven't read it lately, but my guess is that it stands up pretty well.
But it was one article, though, and I think generally the coverage has been largely decontextualized. It has been on our side and us versus them.
But I mean, what else is new? I think that's true of everything. And you will, if you go looking for it, as this caller obviously went looking for it and found it, you will find it. I mean, it is true. Look, most, especially TV news, I mean, I'll say this because I have no stake in it. Most mainstream TV news is just pretty stupid about everything. I mean, let's face it. I mean, you won't learn anything about why something happens about anything watching most of these shows. So should you learn about the war on terrorism?
Which one
why
of
should
you
expect? You know?
Which one of you is the media critic again? Right. But and there was a debate. And it's true. You're right. You're not going to find it in most media sources that the average person who's not a news junkie or a policy junkie runs into. But there was not a simple or agreed upon explanation about what the terrorists wanted.
Well, that's
and
true.
That
yeah.
was spun too, because people were saying, well, what they want is to set up a caliphate, an Islamic Sharia law country in the United States and everywhere else. Other people said, well, they really had political grievances about U.S. Troops in Saudi Arabia and other particular things.
I also think we need to distinguish between the terrorists and the Arab street. The Arab street has its grievances against the U.S. for policies that support dictatorships that we have seen come under threat or fall in recent months in the Arab Spring. I mean, this is a lot of these are leaders, including Gaddafi and Saddam before him, that the Americans supported. And they still support what amounts to autocracies and dictatorships throughout the region when it serves our interests. So that's the Arab street. They create possibly a home for some of these terrorists. They are not committing these terrorist acts, though. So there is a difference between grievances in the Arab street and the Taliban.
So what? Go ahead.
Well, there was also, you know, a tendency early on, if anybody tried to make, it's kind of like the Bill Maher thing, if you tried to make any explanation, you know, not like you were endorsing it or saying that it was just desserts, but if you tried to make any explanation of why they did this, you were accused of making excuses. I remember Susan Sontag had this essay, and she was accused of being anti-American, and you know, just it was crazy.
The Blame America First crowd, and that kind of litmus test journalism that, you know, the need for the flag pin, not just on your lapel, but in your scripts and in your mind, seemed to become paramount and created a problem of providing context. Context itself became conflated with being anti-patriotic. And so I really do understand the caller's complaint.
We will wrap it up with two ideas. One, we will let former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld articulate on reading the newspapers during the Iraq War in 2006.
I picked up a newspaper today, and I couldn't believe it. I read 8 headlines that talked about chaos, violence, unrest, and it just was henny penny. The sky is falling. I've never seen anything like it. And here is a country that's being liberated.
Do you remember that?
Very well. you know, this guy, I mean, there are maybe, well, I don't know. This guy was a real disaster. I mean, you know, here's the thing. Rumsfeld...
Nostradamus proclaims.
Yes, right. It takes a lot of insight to see that now. You know, Rumsfeld had no interest in what happened to Iraq after Saddam Hussein fell. He went into this because it was a kind of to oversimplify a bit, a lab test for his theory of transformation, of the glory of high-tech weapons, and an illustration to all the other bad guys in the world that we can kick you out of power with one arm tied behind our back. He had no interest in what – to tell somebody, oh, freedom's messy. You know, don't worry. Yeah, everybody's
– Stuff happens.
Another
stuff
famous happens. Rumsfeld quote, when the chaos broke out, freedom is messy.
Disastrous.
And Brooke, last idea, what about the coverage of the military action now in Libya?
I think the coverage of the military action in Libya, to the extent that information was available and it has been spotty, has been much more balanced. But, of course, we have far less at stake in that conflict. And coverage seems to improve in inverse proportion to the general direct stakes of the United States.
Brooke Gladstone is the host and managing editor of WNYC's and NPR's On the Media. What are you doing Sunday?
Sunday will also be we will be talking about the effects of 9/11 on civil liberties, on freedom of information and privacy. There are lots of interesting new rules that are blamed on terrorism now, like not being able to take photos of public buildings for which there's no basis in law.
Fred Kaplan is senior fellow at the New America Foundation, writing a book on the history of counterinsurgency and the war stories, military affairs columnist for Slate, and they are married. And Fred, what are you going to be doing? You don't have a Sunday radio show, and actually Brooks is on tape, so what are you going to do for breakfast on Sunday morning?
We're actually on a plane Sunday. We're going to be flying on a plane.
We're flying to Stanford on September 11th.
Husband, wife, Brooke, Fred, thank you both very much for joining us and talking publicly together.
Thanks. It was really fun.
It was really fun. Decade 9/11 series. Our pairings continue. Our series of pairings continue tomorrow at the same time. Suketu Mehta, New Yorker contributor and author of books about New York and Mumbai, meets Pete Hamill, formerly of the New York Daily News and other papers, and author of Tabloid City. That's going to be great, I think. Suketu Mehta and Pete Hamill together tomorrow in our Decade 9/11 series. Again, a reminder to join me for our 9/11 morning coverage and conversations together. We'll have guests, Leanne Hansen, others. We'll talk to you on the phones. We'll observe the moments of silence. We start at 8:40 on Sunday morning and go until noon. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and coming up next, Alice Firing on her book, Naked Wine. Now, that's different from organic wine, but she asks, why does wine need any ingredient other than grapes? We'll get the answer.